Thanks very much. Lovely to be here, and thank you for your welcome. I was told that what you wanted was information and not looking for a sermon, so that's what I'm coming here with. It's. I understand also that, like myself and the members of my church, that people here have a very, very strong heart for justice, particularly for refugees. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the specifics, because one of the things that I find is that people who are allies in this space, people who want to be able to do work, often need to have some of the detail so they can understand what's going on. I'm also happy at the end of this to take some questions, but I would ask that we don't record so I can give you clear and honest answers, if that's okay. So I want to start by talking about what are Australia's obligations towards refugees and people seeking asylum. And I'm going to start by talking about our legal obligations, mentioned on the lawyer, so I can't help it, as opposed to our moral obligations, which is a whole other thing. So our legal obligations pretty much begin and end at the international agreements that we have signed, which address who is and who is not a refugee, what constitutes political asylum, and the rights of children, and also the Convention Against Torture. So Australia has already signed up to the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees. So that's what we refer to as the Refugee Convention. The 1967 Protocol relating to the status of refugees, the Refugee Protocol, and in more recent times, the 2018 Global Compact on Refugees, the Compact, and that's quite a significant one that we need to be mindful of. So we implement these international agreements through legislation and policy, or we should be. The primary Australian legislation of interest that I'm talking about today is the Migration Act 1958 and the Migration Regulations 1994. I think the key obligations for the treatment of refugees lie within the Convention, and that's the right to non-discrimination, the right to work, freedom of religion, the right to housing, the right to not be penalised for illegal entry, I'll come back to that, the right not to be expelled from a country unless the refugee poses a threat to national security or public order, and the right not to be sent back to a country where their life or freedom would be threatened. So that's otherwise known as the principle of non-refoulement. And refugees, in return, must abide by the laws of the country that they are currently residing in. So while Australia does have currently a refugee settlement program, people who have not had their status yet determined as to whether they're refugees, so we're talking about people who are seeking asylum, that are not covered by our international obligations towards refugees specifically. Instead, what we're finding is that people who are seeking asylum are relying on a bit of a hodgepodge of rights when it comes to seeking for protection under other international instruments, such as the Convention Against Torture and the Rights of Children and Young People and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So a little bit about the timeframes for determining whether for people seeking asylum who are hoping to be recognised as refugees. Unfortunately, the current timing around these processes are long and, unfortunately, inconsistent. So on average, it's taking nearly 3 years for an initial determination from Home Affairs regarding refugee status and permanent protection, and the Administrative Appeals Tribunal takes on average a further 2 years if that avenue needs to be sought. But I need to point out that that's the average that we're talking about, and we've got many, many more people who are currently living within Australia who are taking substantially longer. And particularly for those people who are designated unauthorised maritime arrivals, I'll speak about that more in a moment, this means that during this period of time it's leaving people without access to language training, healthcare or job rights for the entire duration of their wait. And we are talking about sometimes people who are waiting over a decade living within our Australian community who are caught up in this limbo. So in terms of assistance available for refugees, the majority of refugee places in Australia are for people who have applied from offshore. And these people arrive in Australia as permanent residents and they are eligible for all of the services that Australian residents receive. In addition, refugee-specific services such as free access to English language lessons through AMEP and counselling for trauma are paid by the government. So that's that number of people who have been recognised as refugees overseas but then managed to come here. So coming back to people seeking asylum, what is available? Well, we have got something called the Status Resolution Support Service, which is a payment, and it's the funding the federal government gives to some asylum seekers. And it covers a basic living allowance. And when I talk about basic, I'm talking about the top tier being 90% of Newstart. And if you think about the campaigns that many of us are involved with to try to ensure that Newstart becomes a livable wage, or livable income rather, this is 90% of that. But it also involves, if you're eligible for SRSS, you get casework support, subsidised medication and access to torture and trauma counselling for organisations like ASSETS, who are doing a fantastic job. So there are currently, there are approximately 70,000 people waiting on a final decision regarding their permanent protection visa, but most of these people do not get SRSS. I'm going to say a lot of the numbers I'm going to give you are going to be a little bit out of date because the Department of Home Affairs and the government don't like publishing figures, but a lot of this has been pulled together from other sources. So since 2018, the Australian government has steadily been tightening the eligibility criteria for this service, and the Department of Home Affairs funds the program and also determines who's eligible. So it's a policy decision rather than a legislative decision, as are many of the decisions made around people seeking asylum. The Minister for Home Affairs is wholly responsible for that program. So at the start of 2018, over 13,000 people were receiving SRSS, and 94% of them were receiving that maximum amount. The changes to eligibility at the time were anticipated to bring the number of people eligible for the service to below 5,000 and to reduce the number of people receiving the top level of support. So as of February 2021, and that was, again, that's the latest numbers that could be found, around 2,000 people Australia-wide were still eligible for SRSS, 2,000. And nearly all of them were receiving the highest available level of support. So the other 68,000 people waiting on resolution of their status are mostly on temporary protection visas or safe haven enterprise visas, so TPV chefs, or their original work, study or tourist visa. However, there are still a large and growing number who are dependent on the final safety net of organisations like CARID to provide emergency relief services like food and housing. As I said, the government doesn't actually report the numbers for SRSS recipients, and only occasionally receives a line item in the budget related to services. So the numbers I've actually presented here are from parliamentary questions. So yay for those people asking the questions. So CARID and other similar organisations like the Asylum Seeker Centre and the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre are providing what should be an emergency food and housing service, but due to policy decisions of successive federal governments that remain ongoing, CARID is increasingly finding itself providing these services for individuals and families, including children, including babies, for years. So we are... In Australia, people seeking asylum are remaining in a state of emergency for years. So the most immediate and useful thing to assist people to have emergencies of reasonable length would be faster decisions on status with work rights and language training in the meantime. That is one of the key asks. So a number of CARID clients are in extreme distress and may not be able to participate in the work in the workplace. For example, we have clients who have got children who are still trapped in positions of danger overseas. And if you can think about how would you react if you knew daily that your children were in danger? You would not really be able to function. I know I wouldn't be able to. But a number of our clients could have and should have been participating in the workforce for years. And can I say, You will never meet someone who wants to work more than a person seeking asylum, and they'll do anything. They will do anything. One of the reasons they want to work and not be on SRSS, if they can avoid it, is if you are on SRSS, you are not allowed by law to send any money overseas to your families. And again, that puts people in a desperate, desperate situation. So people want to work. They want to work. And what I am seeing is that as people are left in this position of being unable to work, being unable to provide any support for their families, do anything like that, they are losing their self-efficacy because there's nothing that legally they can do to help themselves in the years and years that they are waiting for a determination status. So a really critical need beyond this is for legal assistance to be able to assist with the minefield that is Australian migration law, both for initial application for refugee status appeals and for appealing the lack of work rights. At one point, I was doing pro bono activity, which was then the humanitarian group, formerly Case for Refugees and now Circle Green. And I will say it's actually one of the most soul-destroying areas to actually practice law in, because every time you found a loophole, it would go back to Parliament and that loophole would get closed. It's really only the Tax Act and the Migration Act that are subject to such regular updates to make sure that holes cannot be used to ensure that we have humanitarian outcomes. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. Actually, no, I won't. I'm going to stay. So thank you. So I want to give you some perspective about the numbers that we're talking about here. So the UNHCR received 1.7 million new claims for refugee status in 2021 alone. 2021, okay? So that's before Ukraine. The USA has provided permanent protection for slightly fewer than 600,000 people over the last 10 years. And that's more than half of the people who have achieved permanent protection as refugees. So in 2021, there were 27.1 million people who were refugees or asylum seekers. Australia is committed to providing permanent protection to 13,750 refugee visas per year, with an additional 4,175 places for Afghani refugees over the next 5 years. So in 2021, 72% of refugees and people seeking asylum resided in neighbouring countries. So to give context to the 100,000 or so people who are currently seeking resolution of status in Australia, this is compared to Turkey, who've got 3.8 million, Colombia, 1.8 million, Pakistan, 1.5 million, Uganda, 1.5 million, and Germany with 1.3 million. And I note that more than 6 million Ukrainians had fled across the border in the first half of 2022. So what that means is 27% of the world's refugees are hosted by the least developed countries, 46 countries that together account for less than 1.3% of global GDP. So that is who is carrying the cost of refugees globally. So Australia has provided permanent protection to under 1 million people since World War II. Australia is one of 20 countries that participate in the formal settlement of UNHCR recognised refugees and has accepted the 11% of the refugees settled through that program. But that program, in total, settles less than 1% of the world's refugees. So there is a massive, massive need that is not being met. So interested in talking a little bit about our performance in relation to our international obligations, what we've signed up to. So as I mentioned before, beyond the distinction between people seeking asylum and refugees, there's also a further distinction between unauthorised maritime arrivals and people who have arrived in Australia by plane. So while the consideration of claims for refuge are subject to the same criteria, the treatment of people who have arrived without a visa during the asylum seeker phase has been very different over the last decade or so. So the policy of turning back boats was tested by the Australian High Court in 2014 and was found to be legal. However, there are a number of international principles that have not been tested. It's not legal to intercept and turn back boats outside territorial waters, except with the permission of the country in which that boat is registered. So within territorial waters, so that's up to 12 miles from shore, foreign boats have the right of innocent passage, and that's under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. However, legally bringing to shore unregistered migrants is not considered innocent passage. So as such, within Australian waters, Australia may impede the passage of seaworthy vessels. Remember, I was distinguishing between the legal and the moral. For non-seaworthy vessels, regardless of what breaches of Australian migration law may be intended, international and maritime law holds that under the Law at Sea Convention, the International Convention for the Safety of Life at Sea, and the International Convention on Maritime Search and Rescue, that Australia has obligations to render assistance to any person found at sea in danger of being lost. So search and rescue operations in cooperation with neighbours are also required. Australia is required to assist boats in distress regardless of their reasons for being at sea. But given the successive governments' refusal to provide transparency about Operation Sovereign Borders, we don't know whether these principles are being upheld. So there is an argument to be made that the lack of transparency in this matter is, I think, a failure of the government's obligation to the Australian people to provide evidence of good governance, though unfortunately there's no law to say that they must. So once Australian officials control a boat at sea, Australian obligations under national and international law apply, including our human rights and our refugee obligations. So as I mentioned before, the principle of non-refoulement. And asylum seekers have the right to not be returned to a country where their life or freedom is at risk. To ensure that Australia is not breaching this article, each individual case must be assessed. So when you are turning back a boat without assessing the claim of each individual, this is putting at risk the breaching of this principle. Australia's performance is very patchy on providing asylum seekers the right to work. So the majority of asylum seekers come to Australia on legal work or study or tourist visas. That's the majority of people who are here. And it's the government's position that the conditions that were on the initial visas should be maintained. So some of those initial conditions include work rights and some don't. So should people fail to comply with their initial visas, such as complete their course of study or overstay their tourist visa, they may apply for a bridging visa E while their claim for refugee status is assessed. So unauthorised maritime arrivals are all given a bridging visa E while their claim for asylum is being processed. And work conditions that may be attached to a bridging visa E include no work, and that's happening far too often, or work for no more than 40 hours a fortnight. So as of December 2022, there were over 10,000 people in Australia on a bridging visa E, with subclasses 041, 051, 052, with 532 of those people in Western Australia. So I really want to emphasise the right to work is particularly critical, as the vast majority of people on Bridging Visa E are not eligible to receive any income support from SRSS. Australia's temporary visas under which a person's refugee status is recognised but permanent protection is not being granted provide work rights. So a CHEV requires that the work be undertaken in rural and remote areas, and a TPV usually doesn't have work restrictions. I think of note is that approximately 95% of people who were granted temporary protection between 1999 and 2008 were later provided permanent protection. So these were the people who were able to demonstrate, despite the difficulties, that they are refugees. And I will say it has been a welcome and rare win in refugee policy that the federal government recently announced earlier this year the transition to permanency for TPV and CHEV holders. It's fantastic. So there is, of course, the right to housing, and the primary concerns about the right to housing as it's enacted in Australia are the sheer cost of housing. and potentially discrimination for the people who aren't in mandatory detention. So people seeking asylum on bridging visas are also, they're also not entitled to access community or social housing, which means that they are left at the mercy of the private rental market, remembering that they're also not able to get a mortgage even if they've been given work rights. So they are left. That is how they are housed. A bit about mandatory detention. So since 1992, Australian law has required that non-citizens in Australia without a valid visa be held in mandatory detention. So immigration detention is mandatory, not time limited, and can't be challenged in court. So mandatory immigration detention for asylum seekers breaches our obligations under the Refugee Convention. So the aspects of it being not time limited and unchallengeable breach our obligations under the International Covenant on Political and Civil Rights and the Convention Against Torture. The Convention Against Torture has also been invoked in relation to the offshore processing regime. So Australian immigration law also doesn't distinguish between children and adults. So children are subject to the same legal requirements as adults with regards to mandatory detention, and the Australian public since 2018 there was an uproar about it. You were probably all involved, I certainly was, and they have largely refused to allow the government to detain children in immigration detention. But it's important to note that despite that uprising of outrage, the law itself has not changed. Even the Australian Human Rights Commissioner has grudgingly accepted that detention long enough to ensure the health and security checks have been made would be acceptable for both children and adults. So Australia has a mandatory detention policy for unauthorised maritime arrivals, which is most certainly a penalty, and this breaches the right to not be penalised for illegal entry. That's Article 31. So this is especially so as the proportion of people seeking asylum by boat whose refugee status is later recognised has historically been and remains very high. So, and of course it is, because why on earth would you actually go through that risk unless you were really desperate? Consistently, people arriving by boat have high rates of being determined to be refugees. For each ethnic or national group arriving by boat, numbers of refugees have historically been found to be between 70 and 100%. And until very recently, arrivals by air have not come close to a similar rate of achieving refugee status. And that's even with a process which is designed to make people fail in terms of their application for refugee status. So, of course, Australia's position in mandatory detention for a number of other reasons breaches basic human rights, and our ongoing lack of a Human Rights Act continues to be problematic. So, historically, the number of asylum seekers arriving by boat has been a small proportion of the number of people applying for refugee status onshore. Throughout most of the early 2000s, that number stayed around 100 people per year and comprised well under 5%. Of onshore applications. However, there was, due to global circumstances, a massive jump from the late 2000s through the mid-2010s, with the peak maritime arrivals occurring in 2012 and 2013, with more than 18,000 arrivals, comprising nearly 70% of onshore claims that year. So the large number of maritime arrivals through these years is known as the legacy caseload, and at its peak represented more than 30,000 people. So the treatment of the people who've been deemed the legacy caseload, I'll discuss in more detail in a moment, as there's a number of concerns to be raised about the way this group has been treated and continues to be treated by successive governments. So in response to the increased numbers, the policy of turning back boats was revived under the new moniker of Operation Sovereign Borders. So boat turnbacks had been stopped in 2007, and the effect can be seen instantly in the number of people reaching Australian shores and applying for asylum in that year. So the United Nations did in 2021 their periodic review of Australia's performance against its human rights obligations, and once again recommended that Australia cease mandatory detention and that it breaches both the Refugee Convention and the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. So no government can claim that they weren't aware. I will say, as a side note, at the commencement of Operation Sovereign Borders, estimates were that 1,500 to 2,000 people had died at sea while trying to reach Australia for asylum. There are no publicly available estimates of deaths at sea since that time, due to the secrecy surrounding Operation Sovereign Borders. So, about offshore processing, Australia sent 4,183 people to Nauru or PNG as part of the Pacific Solution for determination of their refugee status and settlement to a third party, not Australia. More than 3,100 of those people were sent after the 19th of July 2013. And the government of the day determined that people sent after that date would never be permitted to settle in Australia. The approximately 1,000 people sent prior to that date were returned to Australia steadily in a process that was completed in 2015. The human rights abuses that in the offshore detention centres have been well documented and are well known. We are talking about sexual assault and torture, including sexual assault of children, and these are known to have taken place in these offshore processing centres. And the government of the day's response to this was to attempt to undermine the authority and the validity of all criticism. There have been, this year, attempts to change the laws in this area, which have failed. Most recently, there was a bill before the Parliament, the Migration Amendment Evacuation to Safety 2023 bill, that would have seen the final remaining people in Nauru and PNG return to Australia for finalisation of their refugee status. That bill was not successful. So, a little bit about... So, the lack of transparency through the offshore processing regime and the obfuscations and refusal to admit that Australia retained jurisdiction over the program has been responsible for the ongoing conditions in the centre, showing Australia's refusal to engage with the human rights abuses it was enabling. And once again, the United Nations have condemned this approach. So I'm going to say a little bit about how we are failing the legacy caseload, because special mention really do needs to be made mention of this. Now, they call the legacy caseload for political and effectively for dehumanisation reasons. The vast majority of people in the legacy caseload are people seeking asylum who arrived by boat in the years between 2012 and 2014. So a combination of decisions by successive governments, building on the foundation which had been set by the response to the MV Tampa, created conditions where 33,000 people seeking asylum who arrived between the 12th of August 2012 and the 1st of January 2014 were barred from even making an application for protection for up to 4 years following their arrival on Australian shores. And so these decisions included excising Australia from the Australian Migration Zone, the Pacific Solution of compulsory offshore processing, a default position of refusing to allow asylum seekers to apply for protection unless by ministerial consent, and the withdrawal of all public funding for legal assistance for this group only. So people subject to offshore processing and those who arrived by air were still eligible for public assistance. So the government retaliating against the Senate decision to disallow the reintroduction of TPVs by putting a freeze on all protection visas, and the decision that that regardless of refugee status, this group would never be permitted permanent residence in Australia, has had a terrible effect. So this group of people have been further affected by the decision to introduce the fast-tracking process. And I've got to say that was one of the things that I was involved with, and it was soul-destroying. So in May of 2017, a deadline of having a protection visa application in by 1st of October of 2017 or be deported was announced. So, however, the refusal of legal assistance continued, with the result that even through what was a heroic pro bono community legal response, people were unable to get their applications in on time. So deportations began in late 2017 without assessment of cases, once again potentially breaching the principle of non-refoulement. So the fast-track process has disadvantaged this group and has overall taken the same amount of time anyway, if not longer, than processing under the regular rules. So people seeking asylum who've been subject to the fast-track processing have shorter timeframes to respond to requests for information than other asylum seekers, and on-paper assessment only, so they're not even granted an interview, and far more limited rights of appeal, including not being permitted to personally face the review panel, nor provide more information. So this lack of independent and proper review has seen a substantial decrease in cases which are being remitted to the department to be reconsidered. This is a failure of due process, and there's just no way that we can justify this. So any claim that this discriminatory process is would worthwhile would need to rest on the speed of processing, because I already said the speed is a problem, but as of 8th of February 2023, more than 1,500 people from that original cohort are still waiting on an initial decision regarding their application for a TPV or CHEV. So these are people who've been waiting for 8 to 10 years, and they've also been excluded from the recent announcement for TPV CHEVs because they haven't even been able to have their claim for asylum assessed. So more than 4,000 people are still working through that review process of an initial refusal. And that's 6 years after the hard deadline which was given to them. So this group was initially refused any chance of permanent settlement in Australia and subject to reapplying for their TPV or CHEVs. The government is now transitioning TPV and CHEV applications and renewals to the new resolution of status visa. And so that is a great area that needs to get reformed. So in terms of settlement services for refugees, a range of support services are offered under the heading of settlement services for resettled refugees from offshore, but not for people who are seeking asylum. So these services commence with cultural information about living and working in Australia and then progress through a casework approach on arrival to assist with language and housing over the course of the next six months to 5 years, depending on need. Imagine if people seeking asylum got something similar. Also, specialised intensive services are available if there's very complex issues. But importantly also, these supports are not available for people who come through community sponsorship programs. So now I'm just going to say a little bit about durable solutions. I mentioned before the Global Compact on Refugees, which aims to create durable solutions to the refugee crisis, while also attempting to ease pressures on host countries, enhance refugee self-reliance, expand access to third country solutions, and support the conditions in the countries of origin for return for people to be able to return in safety and dignity. So this compact is recognising that root causes must be addressed that are causing people to have to flee in the first place. And that is in line with international law and the Charter of the United Nations, political and security cooperation, diplomacy, development and the promotion and protection of human rights are being key to resolving protracted refugee situations and preventing new crises from emerging. But it's also recognised that these are slow solutions, because they are. The vast majority of refugees remain globally in a temporary situation for a period of months to years or even decades, in some cases lifetimes, before returning to their original country. For most people seeking asylum, this would also be their preferred outcome. They want to return to their homes and their neighbourhoods and their lifestyles and their culture and their families. The desire for this outcome is so strong that people repatriate even while others are fleeing from that same nation. We're seeing that in the Ukraine, and for example, more than 250,000 people returned to South Sudan in 2021, while more than 2.4 million people fled. So the Australian government does not make figures available on voluntary return publicly available. So where the country of origin requests, the Global Compact requires signatories to provide assistance in creating the conditions in the country of origin that make it possible for people to return in dignity and safety. So assisting in providing resources for voluntarily repatriated refugees is also expected of signatories. So to work towards this obligation, Australia is meant to provide expertise and resources to countries that request it to assist in creating conditions that make it possible for people to be able to return. So that means Australia, by signing up to the compact, is meant to be supporting peace, civil infrastructure and good governance in those countries. So Australia's existing foreign aid and development program is the obvious area in which to fund and resource these efforts. But Australia's foreign aid budget, as a percentage of GDP, lags the OECD average at 0.2% of GDP compared to the OECD average of 0.34%. And the UN Sustainable Development Goals is for 0.7% of gross national income, and foreign aid has also steadily decreased as a proportion of the federal budget as opposed to GDP. So it was at a high of 2.4% in the early 1970s, and now it's 0.7% in the current budget. So it's hard to see that Australia is able to meet its obligations and meeting the goal of voluntary resettlement when we have got a steadily decreasing level of commitment. So Australia has also not been assisting with creating the peace needed for rebuilding physical and social infrastructure. And we've got, for example, substantiated reports that Australia has sold arms to countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 2018-19. So that is not consistent with our obligations under the compact. As I said before, less than 1% of refugees are permanently resettled. And that's not because there isn't a need, it's because countries are not making those places available. So Australia has traditionally been one of the largest receiving countries for permanent resettlement within the program. But the Global Compact is seeking to increase the pool of permanent resettlement places around the world. So for countries such as Australia that have the capacity to do this, we should be focusing on enlarging the scope and the size and the quality of our resettlement programs. But instead, Australia has reduced its permanent resettlement places from over 18,000 in 2018-19 to 13,750 in this year and through the budget forward estimates. And throughout the COVID years, the resettlement numbers dropped below 10,000. So the expansion of complementary pathways is another durable solution in the Global Compact, and complementary pathways provide ways for people seeking asylum to migrate to other countries that do not depend on providing a case for being the most desperate 1% who achieve resettlement. So community-supported programs like CRISP, which you may want to ask about, is one of the programs that has been established here. But they are really good. They enable people to be able to come together to bring people, families who've been identified as refugees come over, and to provide effectively a year's worth of support and a whole range of other things. We have the CRISP program. It's modelled on the very successful Canadian program, except that the numbers of people who've been identified as being able to come through the CRISP program actually are within the overall numbers that have been approved by government, whereas in other governments, it's over and above the numbers of people. So effectively what this government has done, whilst it's a great program, is they've handballed the costs of this from them to the community to actually undertake this work. So that's CRISP. But there's also other programs you can do, such as there's employment programs. And at the moment, we've got 200 places nationally for refugees who have specific skills who are able to access, to be able to come to Australia. And there's potentially other opportunities that other jurisdictions are using, such as being able to come via as students and to go from there. So, look, the last decade has seen an increasing trend of conflict globally and a steadily increasing number of people who are being forcibly displaced, including refugees. Since 2010, displacements and refugees have far outstripped the ability to find those durable solutions. So, by explanation, refugees are people who've crossed an international frontier and are at risk or been victims of persecution in their country of origin. Internally displaced persons, because that's also an issue, have not crossed any international frontier but have, for whatever reason, also had to flee their homes. So the numbers of people who are at risk is even higher than reflected in the figures I've given you. There's also going to be huge challenges as climate change becomes more of an issue. And Global Trends in Forced Displacement notes that 95% of all places seeking conflict displacement are in countries that are vulnerable or highly vulnerable to climate change, and that 78% of new refugees in 2021 came from these areas. There is a huge amount of work to be done in that space to understand what that actually means, but this is going to be a challenge for us as we move forward. So I just want to say that the new government has made some strides towards addressing addressing some of the human rights concerns, progressing people on TPVs and CHEVs towards a resolution of status, and finalising the offshore processing regime are good steps. But working to get people out of detention is also has been a welcome initiative, but there's a long way to go to meet our obligations, both in terms of stemming the number of refugees globally and our treatment of people seeking asylum once they are here in Australia. And I'm particularly concerned about this legacy caseload. It's beyond time that we do something for these people, and they have endured enough. So I'm happy to take any questions.